We should probably take more cocaine then.
That would help. I guess. I don't know. I have no frame of reference.
You should just try it. Just see.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are my co-host, Richard Wally.
And you're my co-host, Cassidy Robinson, from the Los Angeles area.
You're really struggling with the word Angeles.
I am. I want to add lots of A's to it.
I mean,
you know, like when you hit the keyboard and you hit it for too long and lots of A's come up? That's what's happening in my brain, apparently, right now.
Right. When you lean on the keyboard and you think aliens are sending you secret messages.
Yeah, no, I don't know what. You have a very specific interpretation of that.
That's not a universal thing? That doesn't happen to everybody?
Possibly not. I mean, maybe I'm the weirdo and you're normal, but, you know.
I just don't know about that. On the top of the show today, I wanted to say we have been featured, sort of tangentially, on a few different podcasts this week. I usually save this stuff for the end, but I figured I might as well just do it right here. Dampercast, our friend Leland Brungart from Olympia, Washington, they just did their Dampercast favorite things of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on the list of favorite things.
Again?
Again. Second year in a row.
Weren't we a runner-up to the bidet?
That's true. I'm so happy that you remember that. Yes.
Of course I'd remember that.
Last year, we were the runner-up to Leland's bidet. This year, we've made it to a full-fledged favorite thing.
That's good.
So
that's good.
That's progress.
The bidet is still probably above us, though, right?
I mean, if we're grading on a curve, probably.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And the other bit of news is over the weekend, I guested on a podcast, a cool podcast that I just started listening to a few months ago called the Great Albums Podcast. And I discussed the Strokes album, Is This It? And it's already up. We recorded that yesterday and it was up this morning. So quick turnaround.
Is it, is that album new? The Strokes album? You know, I don't know about music.
No, that came out when I was in high school or when we were in high school, 2001.
Do you just discuss whatever album or how do they choose that?
I sent them like a letter, like a, hey, I like your show, blah, 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 blah. As I do with most podcasts that I listen to and have been listening to for a while. And then they invited me on and I gave them a short list of albums I would discuss and they picked one. And that happened to be the one they wanted to talk about. They would want the guest, whoever it to be, to have some sort of input in the, you know, the discussion. So, yeah, I have to say, though, I was a little bit nervous. Like, going on, because A, even though I've listened to the album a lot and over the last, you know, whatever it is, almost 15 years now, which makes me feel ancient, SAT time, like I had to like cram. And so I like went on the Wikipedia page and tried to read as much about it as possible and like read the lyrics for the first time because I never really done that before.
Well, what's funny to me is that you haven't, when you started reviewing things, you started by reviewing music. I mean, that was back in high school, granted, but
right. That's
where you started.
Well, kind of both. I took newspaper for my English credits for like 3 of my 4 years of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that, I was always kind of involved in the entertainment page. Or whatever. So I would always, I would usually be reviewing either CDs, which I did a lot. But I reviewed a few movies within that time. I remember I reviewed Zoolander. I reviewed...
How was your review of that? Positive?
I liked it. It worked. I reviewed Orange County. This is the part of the podcast where I date myself.
Yeah, most people won't know what you're talking about.
Well, most people younger than me anyway.
I think older and younger. I think there's a very like brief time period that you could say Orange County. People will be like, oh yeah, that movie.
Jack Black. I also reviewed Spider-Man. Sam Raimi's Spider-Man. I don't remember other things. Big Fish, I think.
Yeah, that came out then.
That's yeah. True. But yeah, it was fun being on that podcast, being on the Great Albums podcast. And what did you do over the weekend or since the last time I talked to you?
Oh, not a lot. I did turn 30.
Oh, yeah. You tried to hide your birthday from me.
Oh, I didn't try. I did.
Well, it was bullshit. And I found out anyway.
Yeah. What's weird, like, I don't remember turning it off or turning it on Facebook. So I don't know. I don't do Facebook. It's just it exists in my life and it's there. And I go on to post the podcast, right. Basically.
Do you like how I immediately get mad at you for not telling me it's your birthday, but I didn't know anyway?
Oh, I don't care. Hey, well, it's one of those things, though. Like, I mean, first of all, I just expect that. You're just not a dates person. Like,
no,
if you were somebody that remembered, like, everybody else's and then you didn't remember mine, then I'd be like, you're an asshole. But since you just don't, like... Sometimes I forget yours, too, and I'm like, oh, yeah. The real reason I remember dates now is because my wife has a calendar brain. She'll be like, oh, yeah, it's this date for this person and this date for this person. And I'm like, I don't know how you do that. So it really doesn't bother me when people forget. Also, I don't celebrate my birthday, really. It's just another day.
That's what I was going to ask. What did you do for your birthday?
I think we had food at home.
Oh, Richard. You didn't even play laser tag or something?
No. I mean, technically we went bowling, but it was for my wife's work party a little bit before that, like 4 days before my birthday.
Okay. Well, I'm going to call that your birthday party.
Well, my birthday party was, we bought a video game and we played it together.
You and your wife?
Yes. The Lego Superhero Adventures, Marvel Superhero Adventure game. It's silly and fun. And that's what we did.
Well, happy 30. Dirty 30.
Yeah, I think when you turned 30, you told me I was going to have an existential breakdown crisis. It didn't happen.
How's that going for you?
Yeah, it's fine. I'm actually, it was one of my most... See, usually my birthday is about my self-loathing raising to its apex and then disappearing right after. But this birthday, it was very apathetic. Nothing happened.
It'll catch up with you.
I don't think it will. I just don't think I... It's just an... It's... I don't feel any different than 29.
It'll catch up with you. Everything's been set into motion already. It'll catch up with you.
Oh, really?
Today we're going to be talking about the horror movie The Boy. And at the end of the program, we're going to be reviewing Otto Preminger's Laura in our Netflix homework. But before that, we're going to do a couple news items. But I'll let you start. What's your first story?
So that McG fellow, you might know him from either TV Supernatural is actually where I came into contact with him. Mm-hmm. And I actually like that show, so judge me.
He's a producer, yeah.
But he directed Terminator Salvation, which was, it was medium. It was mediocre entertaining.
Right.
If I may use the word. But anyways, he is now being set to oversee the new Masters of the Universe movie. You know, He-Man and all that kind of jazz.
Yeah.
So I mean, I watched that show when I was a kid, but I really don't have much of an opinion over it. Then there's a blonde dude that fights a skeleton man. Like, that's exactly what I know about Masters of the Universe. So do you have a lot to say about this? Because I don't know. He's an okay, like, workman's director. I don't think he's, like, great. I don't think he's really very bad either, though. So.
Well, Terminator Salvation is probably his best movie, and that's not saying a lot. He's also the same director who did This Means War and the Charlie's Angels movies.
This Means War was an abomination. That is true. I forgot it existed until you said it right now.
And though that's better than the Charlie's Angels movies.
I don't remember the Charlie's Angels movies at all.
You're better off. He also did a movie called, I don't know, what was it called? It was some football movie starring Matthew Fox and Matthew McConaughey. I never actually saw that. That might actually be okay.
I don't know.
But yeah, no, I'm not a huge McG fan. I think his net average is pretty low. If you're
again, the reason why I give him a little bit of whatever is because I did enjoy Supernatural for the first at least five seasons.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's not a good show. It's just fun, poppy, people shooting monsters stuff. I enjoy it for that kind of dumb quality. But
no, Supernatural was fun. I mean, it was the CW's answer to X-Files.
Well, it was CW's version, which does make it quite different than X-Files.
Right, exactly. I mean, the little bit of it I've seen, I've never been like a full-on, like, sat down and watched a full season kind of thing, but I sat down on probably, you know...
It's a boy soap opera. It's with monsters.
Right. I found it mildly amusing. So maybe that kind of camp or that kind of, like, pulp would be something he would approach Masters of the Universe with. Here's my thing with Masters of the Universe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any way you can do that material without it being super campy.
Like, well, you're not wrong.
Like, but that's not really what's in right now. I think the trend is to make it dark and gritty.
Sure.
And to make it cool, you know, K-E-W-L.
Yeah, and specifically Masters of the Universe, I don't think there's a version of that. Maybe, but...
A movie version? There was one in the 80s. No, go back and watch that. It has not aged well. It's perfectly the right level of camp that it needs to be, even if it wasn't doing it on purpose. Courtney Cox was in that movie, weirdly enough.
I do remember that. Got one.
I mean, that movie had very little to do with the actual Masters of the Universe, because they kind of did it like Thor movie style, where he's in, where's He-Man again?
He-Man Land,
yeah. And then he comes to Earth and spends most of the movie down there.
I see, I haven't seen that since I was, again, the whole property, if you're talking the cartoon, everything.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any of it. I have no reference since I was a kid. I remember there's a talking tiger that's kind of a wimp.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there's monsters that are bad guys, but they're kind of dumb, so they don't really do much.
Right.
But I always liked their designs when I was a kid.
And then Skeletor.
Skeletor, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all I got.
Yeah, I have very little opinion. I have no horse in the race here. Like, I don't really care if it's good or bad or whatever. I don't suspect it will be great. But, you know, I just feel like if there was a way to do this movie, it's to embrace how silly the source material is and go with it. And maybe McG will do that. I just don't think he will.
I mean, if he made it like Terminator Salvation, which, you know, a darker, gritty, whatever thing, that makes sense for that kind of property, Terminator.
Right.
Masters of the Universe, yeah, I do think it would have to be colorful and dumb. Somebody, I guess I would be more likely, I'd like to see the guys from, like, 22 Jump Street, Lord and Miller, Chris, are they both Chris's? One of them's a Chris.
Anyways. Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
That's it.
Yeah, I mean, something in that realm. I think they might be a little overused at this point, but yeah, something in that realm.
Yeah, something in that realm. Not nearly. I was going to add to that idea that it wouldn't be so meta, because right. I think that would be really, really weird.
I would have said a few years back, I would have said John M. Chu, but he kind of dropped the ball on Gem and the Holograms, so I'm not so sure anymore.
Pretty disappointed.
My only news story is Sam Raimi is in talks to direct a remake of the French thriller A Prophet for Sony.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be an American remake, obviously. It'll be in English. And it's kind of a well-regarded foreign film from its time. And, you know, it's kind of a slightly more widely seen than the average. You know, it has some amount of crossover appeal.
I haven't actually caught up with that one. I meant to at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about it is I thought it was newer than that. So with 5 years passing, at first I was like, oh, great, they're going to, just make a movie, and then right after they're going to remake it. Right. There's actually been a bit of time, and it could change. And with Raimi, it depends on what direction.
Right.
When we just watched A Simple Plan, that was actually, I thought, pretty decent. And so if he does something
good
like that, I could really see it. But if he goes with his camp value and his, you know, his kind of schlock fest,
right,
I couldn't see it going as well.
I don't think he's going to turn it into Darkman.
Okay. There's enough Darkmans now.
The screenplay is going to be written by Dennis Lehane, who wrote the novels Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone were based on.
Okay.
So he's like a famous crime novelist.
See, if we're talking just pedigree, it has a decent pedigree for a movie to say like, oh, this could be a decent movie.
But one of the things that's kind of funny about, not funny, haha, but kind of like curious about this project is like the original story was about an Arab who was put in a French prison and like becomes like a mafioso.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a, I guess, sort of Godfather-ish sort of rise and fall story. I'm not quite sure, like, the nationality thing, how they're going to do that. Is it going to be, like, a Hispanic guy, or is it going to be Arab still, or what?
Well, if it's Arab, you can get into a lot more, political kind of, like, territory, because it wouldn't necessarily have to be a gangster.
Right.
I mean, if you wanted to get really kind of weird, you could be how the system turns, you know, a normal Arab guy into, like, a terrorist or something like that. I mean, that's very dark and a very, scary way of going.
Get into some hairy territory when you're dealing with that kind of, like, racial politics. What if he was from Canada?
Well, then he deserves it.
A French-Canadian.
It's perfectly acceptable to abuse Canadians. That's fine. That's fine.
That'd be the safest route.
Yeah. Abuse Canadians.
Okay, and that pretty much covers our movie news. We're not going to do too much of that this week, because I kind of wanted to discuss at some amount of length, and it's sort of a news item, this whole controversy with the Oscars So White campaign. Basically, we didn't talk about it on the show, I don't think, but they announced who the official nominees were for the Academy Awards this year, and there was a surprising lack of diversity, as seen by some members of the Academy, as well as other actors who weren't included. And it seems like everybody is talking about this right now. And there's been enough buzz about it and enough kind of power back behind this Twitter campaign that the Academy actually answered back to it. And they are going to change some of their rules to hopefully correct for it. I have the page open that the Academy wrote, sort of outlining their new rules. I'll read from it a couple paragraphs here, just to kind of give us a better context of what we're looking at. Beginning later this year, each new member's voting status will last 10 years and will be renewed if that new member has been active in motion pictures during that decade. In addition, members will receive lifetime voting rights after 3 10-year terms, or if they have won or been nominated for an Academy Award. We will apply these same standards retroactively to current members. In other words, if a current member has not been active in the last 10 years, they can still qualify by meeting other criteria. Those who do not qualify for active status will be moved to emeritus status. Emeritus members do not pay dues but enjoy all the privileges of membership except voting. This will not affect voting for this year's Oscars. And then it says underneath that, at the same time, the Academy will supplement the traditional process in which current members sponsor new members by launching an ambitious global campaign to identify and recruit qualified new members who represent greater diversity. So it kind of sounds like a SAT question. But
if you're traveling to Georgia on a freight train of 250 miles an hour and a plane is traveling,
I mean the basic gist of it that I caught is that there's going to be a quicker turnaround for membership status, and like, you know, if you're old and white and haven't done anything in the last like 20 years, then your membership could be passed down to somebody younger and maybe of different racial variety.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what the gist I got from that.
Right.
I haven't really seen any of the official Oscar stuff yet. So that, I mean, that's interesting to hear that they've actually done something.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of shows you how full force this Twitter campaign was. Cause I thought everybody complains about the Oscars for some reason or another every year.
Mm.
Like it's either like, oh, there's not, you know, how did they forget this movie or forget that movie? Or, oh, there's not enough indies or there's not enough women on the being nominated. It's like every year there's something, and this year I thought it was just going to kind of go by past the Oscar season and then everyone will forget again. I don't know. Maybe it's just the Twitter activism thing is a lot more set up for immediate results than it was in years previous.
For Oscars in the entertainment industry in general, I mean, they're a little bit more reputation based in general. They have to kind of at least take into consideration what people are saying a little bit.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of companies that don't. They don't need to give a shit at all. You know, the weapon manufacturing industry, they don't care. They don't care about anything. But, you know, movies, on the other hand, I mean, people go and see them. People, you know, and that is a large part of their crowd that actually goes and watches and participates within the film industry. And if we're talking about that, it is a little weird that this year, I mean, you can debate who, but I found it a little weird, like somebody like Michael B. Jordan wasn't nominated. I didn't see Creed, but he got enough buzz around his performance that I figured he would. I also thought maybe he was being punished for Fantastic Four. Maybe that was some kind of thing, but because that sometimes does happen with the Academy. Like if you have a bad, really bad movie come out in a year and a really good movie come out in a year, sometimes they kind of pit them against each other. Mm. So I don't know. And then I guess the kind of term and the idea of boycotting it got started by Spike Lee, but then he turned around and was basically like, I wasn't necessarily saying boycotting. I was just saying, I'm not going personally this year because it's a little too white for me. And that's the most, I've just heard the buzz behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't really go out searching these kind of articles. This is just the stuff that's really popped up. It's been right in my face. So it's not like this has been hidden, you know, under a rock. If it reaches me, it basically means that it has passed several filter layers to get to me.
Right, it must be pretty loud for you to have read and paid attention to it. I guess the broader question to ask here is, what is your overall opinion of the idea of this complaint?
Oh, as a cisgender white male, what is my opinion?
Yes. Like, do you think that it matters? Do you think that there should be more racial diversity represented in the nominations? Or do you think that, you know, best performance is best performance, regardless of race, gender, blah, blah, blah? I mean, it's already gendered because there's the best male and female supporting and main performance. Mm-hmm. So there's already like that kind of representation allowed.
Right.
But within that, do you think that there is a lack of racial diversity? And if there is, do you think correcting for it is a good thing or?
You know, for me, again, bringing up I'm a cisgender white male.
Right.
You know, some of the one of the arguments I heard was basically that we don't know how the votes came out.
Mm.
Like specifically, like, I mean, Creed or whoever, Michael B. Jordan in his performance could have been just a few points shy of making it to the list. You know, I don't know how the votes work either.
Right.
So for me, this is like super, this is super from the outside looking in. And so from a number wise, that kind of, you know, from my background and like being, you know, participating in like, psychological research and stuff like that, that makes sense. Sometimes numbers do that, you know.
Yeah.
It's not always numbers clinically aren't always nice. They sometimes can, you know, not be nice at all. They can not be PC. They cannot be diverse. They cannot be a lot of things. So, in that sense, maybe you don't know. But on the other hand, yeah, maybe there are just a lot of maybe there's just a lot of white old males that are voting, and that's the reason. specifically, I guess it's a little weird that the fact that, you know, some of the movies I wouldn't necessarily, I don't know if they're necessarily that deserving. Like, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, I really enjoyed Straight Outta Compton.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think there was anything that was necessarily that Oscar worthy about it. It was kind of, there was some of it that was kind of messy.
I agree. And
it was a fun biopic pick. It was, you know, but on the flip side, if we're looking at that too, something like Walk the Line,
mm-hmm.
which I, you know what, might be a little bit better edited, but I don't think it's necessarily more fun or that much better in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that it was part of the Oscars race that year and was nominated for things.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just
Reese Witherspoon won that year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, see, there you go. There's one. So I think it's very complicated. I don't blame anybody for being like, I don't know if I can participate or not, but I just don't, in these kind of situations, if I'm being very honest,
yeah,
I really just am like, I have no horse in this race. I'm going to go, I don't know, and just kind of put my hands up because I don't really, you know. One thing that they did do that I think maybe helped them in the past was they did have like 10 candidates for Best Picture.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess even within that, you know, expanding that, it's still not really making up for the lack of diversity. I think the problem goes back further than who's voting for what. The problem goes back is that there's not enough roles being offered to people of different races.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's the root of the problem is like, there's not enough roles, and there's not enough movies really being made. We talk a lot about representation on this podcast and seeing other types of cultural specificity, and we've talked a lot about how movies about, you know, very specific cultural leanings don't travel well when you're talking about the global market, so they're not being made as often.
That's very true as well.
And
well, I mean, I think at the world market, too, I think what's kind of maybe weird about that is there is kind of a diversity movement in the United States that's a little bit bigger now. And that's not necessarily worldwide. I think that you're right about the roles. I think specifically there aren't enough roles, not just acting, like acting roles, but I mean, director, sound, all of that, that are offered to, you know, a more diverse audience.
Right.
But if we're talking at the global market, yeah, it doesn't sell as much. People from other countries, I think, kind of want to see the squeaky white version of America because I don't know why, because that's what they're used to. I'm not really sure.
Right.
I mean,
the other thing I would say about this is I think everybody is taking the Oscars way too seriously as a thing.
I like that point. That's why I said I have no horse in this race as well. I mean, I think it goes for both of us, kind of. I think I think you do the Oscars. You like to do the little voting and try to, you know, watch all the movies. It's like a fun little thing
for
you do.
For fun. I don't look at the Oscars and go like, oh, well, those are the best movies of the year. It has been voted. It is set in stone. Whatever opinion you might have around that doesn't count. Those are definitely the best movies of the year. And whichever one wins is officially the best movie of that year. I frequently disagree with many things that happen with the Oscars. For me, that's part of the fun of watching it, is to argue with it and, why wasn't this, what are they thinking?
I mean, I've never agreed with the Oscars. I mean, I don't, there was one year that I thought it was pretty decent. There was a lot of great directors I liked and they were all nominated that year.
Right.
But other than that, most years it's like, wow, these are really bland. And again, we're a podcast that I think talks a little bit more about, you know, cult movies. We both enjoy cult movies a little bit more than Oscar movies.
Well, like, I mean, if you just look at
we had Dope and we didn't have Creed on our best 10.
Yeah, exactly. And you just look at our top 10s and see how they differ from, you know, what's out there, generally speaking, and especially in the award season. Which isn't to say that I think all awards movies are immediately crap. Some are good and can even be great, and some aren't. But, I mean,
this is just one of those moments you want to tell the internet to be quiet.
A little bit, but I also see, the only thing that I could see is like a solid argument for why the Oscars should change. Because honestly, if anything, I think that those who see a problem here should try and not fix the Oscars, but to fix the problem, which is there's not enough roles for other races being offered, and there's not enough movies about other cultures being made. That's the real problem.
Well, and especially that's what, especially movies that are like not just about the same things.
Yeah, not movies about gangsters, or not movies about, you know, hip hop artists or things like that.
I like crime. I like crime stuff. I like seeing, you know, bad white people too. But that's not the only communities that exist in these communities, even the dangerous, violent ones.
Right. Imagine if as white people,
yeah,
the only movies we could see about other white people were gangster movies. Like, yeah. And that was it. It was like that, and then like movies about country artists, and then Adam Sandler comedies, who's our Tyler Perry. Like, imagine if that was it. Like, that was, and then every once in a while, you would get like one or two interesting good movies, but they were super tiny and you couldn't see them. Like, yeah. That's the world that other people and other races live in all the time.
The other thing that, even if we're talking about the specifically the black community, there are urban black people. This is true. There are just as many people that are from the country.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and we don't see a lot of movies about them either. The only one I can think of the top of my head is Black Snake Moan. And yeah, if that got to the Oscars, I would have laughed my ass off. I love that movie. Don't get me wrong. That is a movie that I bought and I really enjoy.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite Samuel L. Jackson performances, honestly. But you don't see a whole lot of movie about country black people that are from rural areas.
Mm. Unless it's like a Mississippi Burning type thing.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's about racism or whatever, and with a capital R. No, yeah, so I think, you know, that's the main problem. And then on top of that, I think, like it's...
Directors, it's Oscars, writers.
Like, you know, it's like, it's a big popularity contest. It's a big pageant. Like, that's all it is. And by the end of the year, most people forget who won what.
I have a shoe in that race. No, I completely agree. I'm bullshitting you a little, but that's just what I do. This is just one of those ones that I'm like, I don't know if I could really participate because, one, the Oscars are just something I watch once a year and it's kind of fun, but I'm not really that involved in.
Yeah.
But I'm also not that involved in the industry. Maybe if I was part of the industry, it would mean more to me.
Mm-hmm. The good argument you can make for the lack of diversity in the Oscars specifically, mm-hmm, is that once you're nominated, your cachet as a actor or cinematographer or whatever goes up tenfold.
Right.
Unless you're Cuba Gooding Jr.
And then you get straight to the bottom of the list.
Right.
Which is kind of true and sad. Well, yeah, it doesn't really make sense and it's backwards, but it's kind of a top-down problem. Like, there's...
Yeah.
I feel like I'm just so outside of the story that it's really just like, well, they should be more diverse in most places.
Right, yeah. it reflects everything.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's that. Let's go ahead and get into our movie review, which has nothing to do with anything we're talking about.
So, The Boy. The Boy is a horror film. Basically, this young woman from the United States goes to England to nanny for a house. She doesn't know much about the situation. When she gets there, she discovers that she's been asked to come into this home to nanny for a doll for this older couple as they go on vacations. They kind of have this weird breaking of the moment kind of introduction to the whole thing, and like she laughs at it. And what they kind of do that's really interesting, specifically the young woman's play by Lauren Cohan, which for most people is going to be best known for her role in Walking Dead. She mm-hmm. plays Maggie. Or you might know her, to bring up Supernatural again, so we have some connections. she was also a character in Supernatural. Anyway, she plays this young nanny who's kind of had some she's had some problems at home with a boyfriend, and
she's on the run.
She's kind of on the run from these problems with him.
Yeah.
And it kind of actually plays into the larger narrative of the story in a subtextual way that's within the dialogue and within the story itself, which is really kind of interesting that they would do this in, you know, a doll movie. What I mean doll, I mean like the subgenre of creepy horror doll movies. And so basically she gets there, she meets this charming grocery boy played by Rupert Evans, who was in Hellboy. He was the little geeky sidekick character.
Yeah, he was like the audience cipher in the first Hellboy. Yeah.
I found him very, very charming in this. And partially the reason I didn't recognize him is because he had his accent. It's amazing sometimes how much that can change what's going on with somebody.
Yeah.
Like if you're taking somebody from the UK or from Ireland and you're putting them into a film and they have to put on an accent, sometimes they come off with a very flat affectation. But when I can see why they got popular in the UK is because they're very charming when they're using their actual native. Anyways, going on from that, so she kind of gets wrapped up and it kind of gets into this almost supernatural, is the doll haunted? Is the nanny getting...
Yeah, is she going crazy? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And for that type of subgenre of like a doll movie, it's actually, they take it very seriously, which is strange because most of them don't. You have to play into the camp factor of this is a doll.
Yeah.
But this takes it very seriously and actually it doesn't do it seriously and then come off like an asshole. It actually is kind of like convincing a little bit. Because they do try to break the tension. Where everybody else around them finds the doll funny, the grandparents completely the parents of this doll, this older couple, the Hillshires, they completely, they completely are saying everything very seriously.
Yeah, like, they're like, no, this is our son. You need to take care of him this way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's weird because what it does is it tells you to be serious, but at the same time, it's like, no, we understand that this is kind of campy.
Right.
So it's basically it's handled well and it's edited well enough that it doesn't feel bogged down to me. I ended up enjoying this. It didn't blow my mind. It isn't the best horror movie out in years or anything like that, but it's a pretty effective little doll
genre
supernatural movie. Genre thing.
Yeah.
And so I really enjoyed it at that level. And since that's kind of in my wheelhouse, it does give it a few more points. I thought that the acting was all done. I didn't see, there was only one performance that I was a little kind of unsure about. And that was mostly the abusive boyfriend. But that might just be stereotyping because like we're from an area close to Montana. So I was just like, yeah, I hate that dude.
He reminded me of, I forget his name, but there's this character from Twin Peaks who from the first moment you meet him in the show, like the show is telling you, you hate this guy. As soon as he entered the plot, I was like, oh, he's doll fodder.
Right.
Like, he is going to get killed. That's what he's here for.
Right. I mean, the Rupert Evans character, who's named Malcolm in the movie, very charming. I wanted to go on a date with him. I'm just saying. He was very charming. Basically, with her, I could see her kind of dropping and being like, I'm in another country, I'm safe, that kind of a feeling. But you kind of notice that it's a little like, really, it's in those more intimate moments when somebody shows that they've been in an abusive relationship in the past. And that's kind of more, that's a more naturalistic. So it does kind of do it in a more movie style way where it's like, oh, I shouldn't be going out with this person, but he's so charming. And he is. Right. Man, I have such a crush on him in this movie.
Apparently, like you're gushing about Rupert Evans.
He was just a cutie.
Yeah, he is. Film. I'm not gonna.
Did you think he was a cutie in this film?
Yeah,
like he was warm and charming. Like I was instantly like, yeah.
I mean, he's been cast and written to be so, but yes.
I mean,
actually,
yes, but
I really liked Lauren Cohen in the movie. I didn't know what she was from because I don't watch Walking Dead. And like I said, I've only really sampled Supernatural. So she was brand new. I was like, I knew she was probably from television, but I wasn't sure where. But I thought that she actually had a lot of like charisma, and she had kind of a coy sense of humor just underneath the surface. I actually think she could be used for comedy and probably pull it off really well.
She has one of her first films. I haven't seen it, but it's Van Wilder 2. That was one of the first films she was in.
Okay. Well, she was probably just TNA in that. But
it could be. Could very well be. I don't know.
But I think that she has a certain kind of charm to her that I think would lend well to comedy.
Agreed.
I was not... I don't know. How do I feel about this movie?
Don't say you weren't charmed by Rupert Evans. Don't say it. I'm just kidding. Go on. No. I'm sorry.
That's all you care about.
Those are fighting words.
Even if I said this movie's fantastic, everyone should go see it now, but I hate Rupert Evans, you would be...
Oh, I'd be up in arms. It's true.
No, he's fine. The cast, for the most part, like you said, the only person I wasn't super into was the guy who played the ex-boyfriend who sort of shows up out of nowhere and is... The movie gets considerably more silly from that point on. Here's my thing. I feel like every character in this movie behaves as if that there's no horror movies in this world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as soon as Lauren Cohen comes to the house and they're like, no, this is our son. And she's like, well, but it's a doll.
Well, but I mean, that's very typical of, genre films in general, not just horror. That's not a positive or a negative to me.
No,
that's
I'm just saying there were several points in this movie where I was like, get the fuck out of there. Are you serious? First of all, this is our son. It's like, right. Well, I'm going to go to the store and pick up some things and maybe y'all.
You're kind of a coward. I'm sorry. If they showed me that money, I'd be staying there. Ghost, no ghost, whatever.
And then the creepy ass portrait of them and the kid who looks like the Mad Magazine kid.
Yeah.
Right.
See, to me, I would be probably like, this is a little weird. And then they showed me the money. I'd be like, okay, I'll stay.
The doll starts moving like places. Like she sat it down on the couch and then she walked in and it's across the room. That would be enough for me. I'm like, I'm done.
See, I think for the amount of money, I would stay.
I'm to stay with a haunted doll.
Yeah, easy.
Okay.
Like,
I'll keep that in mind.
is this how you're going to pay me back? I don't know for what, but...
Everything's set in motion, Richard. This movie is exceedingly silly.
Oh.
Like, I mean, if you... Even though it's played pretty straight, you can't escape the Goosebumps vibe of the whole thing. Like, it's very potboiler. It's very well-worn horror movie territory. And there's some reveals and stuff towards the end that kind of delve into other horror movie territory.
Because it is kind of so stock and potboiler that by even saying that, I would be like, oh, so this kind of happens. See, I'm glad I didn't even see previews. I almost didn't see anything about this movie.
I saw very little to nothing about it. No, I think it's fine. For a January movie, for a January horror film, you could certainly do a hell of a lot worse. And I think if you're a 14-year-old girl who you've never seen a lot of horror movies and like you want to have a slumber party, this will probably be the PG-13 horror movie to kind of scare you a little bit, but not too much. And maybe is a good testing the water with your toes kind of thing to get into the genre in a big way. I don't know. I had a hard time taking much of it, any of it, all that seriously enough to really be scared by it. And also, I thought the jump scares were, it's a pop horror movie, so I'm not really looking for like deep psychological terror.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that it had very few tricks in its bag as far as how to induce scares.
I think for the type of genre, the type of subgenre is what I mean, being a creepy doll movie. This is like the most pristine version of that I've almost seen, because of its subject matter. I don't necessarily disagree with you completely, but I kind of had a fun time with this, more than The Visit or whatever that one, the M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh, yeah, I would say that too, yeah.
I'm saying is this is kind of decent for what it is. Like, really, I've seen way worse.
No, I would agree with you. It's when I walked away from it, I said it was kind of dumb and really silly, but I can't say I didn't sort of have a good time.
Somebody going to this kind of a film in January, I think they kind of want that. Like, I don't know. Again, I enjoyed this more than it was. I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with it. Mm-hmm. It's not very good. Your comments aren't necessarily untrue. It's just, I like genre films. This is a pretty decent version of this subgenre of doll movies.
Right.
I still would probably prefer like an 80s, like maybe the, like just the movie Dolls or something like that.
Or like Child's Play kind of thing. Or...
No, not Child's Play. I actually probably prefer this more than Child's Play.
Wow.
I've never really liked Child's Play series. Because, I mean, they actually started out very serious as well. And I just couldn't help but be like, just kick the little fucker. Just kick him. Like this, at least there's like a supernatural, something that you can't exactly tangible do anything with. With him, it's like there's a spirit stuck in a doll. Kill the doll. Just grab the little doll, put it in the fire. You're done. Dunzo. And that's
I would say that Richard Attenborough's magic, if you're talking about this genre, is probably maybe the high watermark.
And see, I would say that this is very close to that one. I couldn't get over the fact that it was a dummy. I mean, yes, it's got Anthony Hopkins in it, I think this is edited pretty well, but it's done in a very genre stock fashion, whereas that one's done more like just like a. Trying to do it like a serious movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't get over the fact that it's a doll. Like,
right. Okay, let's move on. We'll go ahead and get into our Netflix homework.
Okay.
Which I assigned you last week. This is Otto Preminger's Laura from 1944. This is a classic film noir starring Gene Tierney and Dana Andrews in the leads. We also have Clifton Webb. And Vincent Price, a very young Vincent Price.
Oh, yes, very young.
I guess younger than most people are used to seeing him anyway.
Yeah. Well, it made me feel like he was a baby in this compared to what I've seen him.
Yeah. Because you're usually used to seeing him a little bit older with the pencil mustache and all that kind of stuff.
Well,
and
even here
he's supposed to play like a dashing leading man.
Well, I mean, he's also like, I'm not used to him not being the lead character in the film either.
Right.
And this, he was a supporting actor. So that was sort of interesting as well.
The basic plot is our lead detective, Lieutenant Mark McPherson. He's been put on this case to figure out who killed this woman named Laura Hunt. She was a young protege who kind of rose quickly in the world of advertising. And while rising, a lot of male attention kind of came her way around the time that she died. So, of course, looking into this, all of these different people, all these possible love interests and stuff, one of them being Vincent Price's character, who's kind of like this Southern dolt. And then this other guy played by Clifton Webb named Walter Leideker, who's this older... sort of mincing, coded gay character, is lead suspects, as well as anybody else who McPherson may end up running into. The plot thickens as the movie goes. So, what did you think of Laura?
I mean, go to the other film we've watched of his, Anatomy of a Murder, is personally, that film really struck me. It was one of those very few movies that was like, I was kind of blown away by. I was like, man, this is great. I could see all the ways that people had copied it in the, you know, going on and where that kind of filmic language came from. Yeah. And I was like, man, this is a really spectacular film. This one's a little bit more boilerplate, but I still feel like we're in a very competent hands.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even so boilerplate that it's like, this is a detective and he's following up on this da-da-da. But all the characters are done well. It kind of makes me, the fact that it's kind of melodramatic, but that it's all in that tone, that one singular tone, really feels good. Because a lot of times in modern movies, they just don't know how to do that. You know, it's like one or two characters, like, you know, they're like, oh, I'm going to do it melodramatic like this. And right. then nobody else is on the same page. People are naturalistic or they're wooden or there are a lot of other things. In this, it's actually, you know, melodramatic. And it, I mean, nobody talks like they do. Nobody explains things like they do in real life. But you feel a realisticness because there's an even tone to it.
You so believe you, the world.
Yeah. There's yeah. just an, there's just a, it's just done more competently than, you know, other films I've seen that have, that are boilerplate and right. that are even from the same era. I mean, if we're being honest, I think that Otto Preminger is known as a, you know, as one of the old greats because he is. Even this, you know, again, immediately after I see anything from Otto Preminger, I'm automatically like, oh, I should watch a David Fincher film. Like, because yeah, I feel like they're both classicists
there.
Well, yeah, they're both very, you know, this is how you classically do a story and a tell and a movie. And they have a very similar ideas and ways they do things. Do you know if Fincher is a big fan of Otto Preminger?
I've never heard him drop that name, but I would not be surprised. I mean, if you look at both this movie and Anatomy of a Murder, even more so, are sort of procedural, you know, this one, they're trying to find the murderer throughout the whole thing. And in Anatomy of a Murder, I mean, that's kind of the plot as well, but it's more of a courtroom procedural.
Right.
And it gets a little bit more into the minutia. This and The Boy, for strangely, have kind of a big plot reveal.
They do. Yeah.
That I don't want to give away. But I will say there's a point in this movie where, because things in film noir language is a little bit more, as you said, kind of melodramatic, but even more so, one of the major themes that runs through film noir is kind of Freudian psychosis with all of the characters. You know, there's a stylization that goes into everything because everyone's not necessarily a person more as they are as a representation of some sort of neuroses.
Well, like the little maid lady, her reactions are so big and so like campy. But at the same time, you feel okay. Cause if that happened in another film, you'd be like, wow, she's really bad. But because it's in the film and it's in that kind of style, like you just go, oh, okay. Like to me, it's just a beat.
Well, she was another character I thought you could definitely read gay. Like I think it reminded me a lot of the Mrs. Danvers thing from Rebecca.
Okay.
I think that I'd be interested in, I mean, I won't ever because I'm lazy, but this is based on a book.
Mm-hmm.
I would be interested to see if it was written more explicitly. And that the movie, because of the code, production code, had to back away a few steps on that. I also think that the character I mentioned before, the sort of older lecherous guy who's the first suspect, there's something about him that seems, I mean, the actor's specifically playing him swishy on purpose.
Right. Well, see, and that's not something that I would necessarily recognize, but with your film background.
Right.
And you would be able to kind of like read into that more. I don't see some of that kind of code stuff. I'm just reading it as a basic, like, oh, well, yeah,
whodunit.
Just,
you know, who it, who's the, it's a whodunit essentially, yeah. But I'm looking at like, what is the neuroses being explored in these characters? Cause that's such a big theme in film noir.
Sure.
And I think even the main character, you know, there's this talk about like, he's becoming a little obsessed about Laura and about finding who it is. And maybe he's more obsessed about the idea of her than he is really about solving the case. And, you know, there's a point in the movie where things change in a big way. And I think you could almost read the second half of the film as like a fantasy if you wanted to. I don't think you have to or that the movie's even necessarily directing you to believe that. But I think it could be read that way.
The boy and this film both have these, you know, these big reveals. And I think, you know what, even though The Boy is kind of silly Donner affair, I still think it had some interesting subtext. I see this film, I don't get as much of a read on because I don't know film noir as much. So that's another reason why you kind of get into those nitty gritty details in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not quite like Vertigo level obsession and Freudian psychology, but it kind of edges that.
Well, it seems like maybe Preminger is more, again, he's a little bit more, he's okay more to like lean on the genre of it,
mm-hmm.
but he kind of does it in a stylistic way that makes it very pleasing and easy to watch.
Mm-hmm.
The genre, to me, it was just kind of boilerplate drama, kind of mystery procedural, like, oh, this happened. And then the reveal, I didn't really feel like did much for the film. It didn't really ruin it either. It just was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of complicates it a little bit, and it sort of turns the movie, you know, the plot inside out on itself. But, I mean, if you read it in the sense of, is this all really happening? Or is this part of the lead character's sort of fantasy of the way he wishes it went? Like, I don't know. It there could be, and it's also sort of a noir trope, it could be a little bit of a unreliable narrator thing going on.
See, I didn't get that at all from this. I thought it was pretty straightforward. The unreliable narrator would be the detective, or the unreliable narrator would be the person you called Swishy.
Possibly either or, depending on how you look at it.
In noir, you're always going to get a character that has dubious motives. I mean, that's right. For sure. I guess the only reason, like, I guess it didn't really, the reveal didn't do much, is because I don't know. I like it when there's a little bit more of a femme fatale. When I like it when all the characters are equally kind of duplicitous. And yeah. I didn't really feel like Laura specifically. It didn't. She wasn't really. She was just kind of seemed kind of there to me. More like a plot point than anything. It didn't really seem like a character even.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I feel like there was a... I felt actually a little bit more from her during the flashback sequences. When we kind of like found out like why she knew all these people and her like humble beginnings and how she sort of, it sort of implied that she was sleeping her way to the top.
Right.
And I thought, I felt like I kind of got a little bit more of like an ethos or pathos from her as a character from those sequences more than when she's integrated into the plot more heavily.
Yeah. It's sort of interesting when you do your like modern read on the film, because I understand that they were hiding those things, but now if they did that, just like obviously, like the film would be very, I don't know. I guess if somebody like Fincher did it, it would be good. But I just imagine the worst kind of movie when you explain it this way.
Well, you look at like, I mean, maybe it wasn't on purpose. Who knows? But if you look at like the Neil Patrick Harris character from Gone Girl.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a clear cut, you know, read of what his sexual orientation is.
No, I think all of the characters in there, I mean, first of all, are morally, but you can kind of, I don't know, there's a lot of weird stuff going on there. Because, I mean, if you're also, you could also be talking about the hinting between the siblings, Ben Affleck and I forgot her name.
Oh, yeah, the sister character.
The sister from The Leftovers. Yeah.
And even actually, structurally, there's some similarities to that in this.
And it's not necessarily that it's not there. It's just sometimes, I don't know, sometimes with some of the older noirs, I'm like, I guess so. Like, I just don't see it as heavily. Maybe if I was exposed to more of them, I would.
See, the people trying to write between the
because Anatomy of the Murder, if we bring up the sexuality in that, that is flagrantly and obvious.
Well,
in
that one's film, a little bit more explicitly, yeah, because that was made in the early 50s when people were starting to buck the code.
Okay.
But this one is made more towards the right in the center of it, when especially within the noir genre,
right?
If you're talking about, you know, things that were to not be discussed, you had to learn how to talk about it between the lines. If you ever get a chance, and then not just you, but any of the listeners, check out a documentary called The Celluloid Closet. It goes all into that.
It's a documentary, you said?
It's a documentary. It was made by, based on Vidar Russo's book, and it was made in like the mid-90s, but it talks about how homosexuals were represented from the silent era all the way up to the mid-90s. And, like, it goes a lot over the code and talks to, like, writers who were still alive and able to talk to the camera about how they got around about writing about things.
Right. Well, I knew, like, in Rope and things like that, but Rope is, I mean, a little bit more obvious, and it's also because
a little bit more. Well, and it's based on a really famous play, and
A really famous play that was based on a real incident,
a real couple.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, you look at like even like Strangers on a Train and that type of stuff.
Sure.
But yeah, no, I like Laura. I thought it was cool. And actually, now that, you know, we got talking about Gone Girl, I'm remembering all of these parallels between the two movies.
Mm-hmm.
Might make a good double feature one day. Okay, cool. So what do you have for me next week?
Next week for the Netflix homework, I'm assigning you the movie Turbo Kid. It's kind of this exploitation, kind of vaguely post-apocalyptic thing. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to have like kids in it being super violent. So I've
That's
heard
always fun.
Decent things. I know it's kind of more on the exploitation, kind of trashy end, but It should be fun regardless.
And if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about this episode, if you have more perspective or have more to say about the Oscars So White campaign, that would be really interesting to read on the show.
Well, if you have a better perspective, that would be great.
Right. Unless you're just a full-on racist, then I probably won't read it.
Well, it depends on who it is. I think, you know, you need to out some people. There are some people we know, we need to out them.
Or if you want to talk about Laura, if you happen to watch that and like it, or if you want to talk about The Boy, whatever you may have thought about that, or anything really, go ahead and email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We're on Twitter as well, @jabberpodcast. Follow us there. You can download us at Stitcher Radio and iTunes, Zune, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network. You can read my reviews that I write weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can read my movie articles and reviews over at the MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Check out Brad Decker's webzine, Getting Off the Ground, or even it's off the ground. It's afloat at medium.com/panel-frame. Reviews, articles, comics, all sorts of crazy stuff. And like I mentioned at the top of the show, be sure to listen to our friend Leland over at his podcast, Dampercast, as well as Rod and Denise over at The Listening Party, as well as Patrick at his podcast, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational, and check out my spot over at The Great Albums podcast with Bill and Brian, who are some really nice guys who speak much better than I do on the mic.
Do they have like those crisp, like very beautiful voices? Like
they have NPR voices.
Okay, they have NPR voices. I tried to do that right now.
A lot of warmth, a lot of, you know, deeper register. Like they, you know, they don't talk into the mic. They make love to the mic.
Cassidy, I'm making love.
And also they're musicians, so they have like good recording gear. So there's that. Okay. Until next week. That's all we have.
Okay. Have a good one.
Bye.